Today on Maine Calling, disruptive student behavior and how to address it. Teachers across the country report a rise in disruptive student behavior, and it is no different in Maine. In a recent survey, 96% of Maine teachers said they had to manage disruptive students, and more than half said they'd managed episodes involving severe or dangerous behavior. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss why this is happening and find out about some new approaches to helping young people who are acting out. There's a shift away from a punitive model to one that's more collaborative. How does it work? And when, if ever, is physical restraint acceptable? A new Maine law gives teachers and administrators more latitude in dealing with potentially violent students. What does this mean in the classroom? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum school recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Disruptive behavior among students is on the rise, from bullying to violence. Today we'll discuss why and what approaches are considered the most effective at preventing problems. Joining me for the hour, Dr. Ross Green, who is a psychologist, author, and founding director of Lives in the Balance. His area of focus is kids with social, emotional, and behavioral challenges, and his latest book is called The Kids Who Aren't Okay. Dr. Sarah Wilkinson is assistant professor of special education at the University of Southern Maine. She serves as a consultant for the Maine Department of Education, and she is a former teacher of history and special education. And Ryan Gleason is principal of Yarmouth Elementary School. He was Maine's 2023 National Distinguished Principal, and he is co-author of Dr. Green's latest book. We invite you to join the conversation. Has your child or some other child you know had school-related behavioral issues? What do you think is going on? Why are so many kids acting out? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us for this hour. Sarah, I'm going to start with you because you've done some extensive research on the scope of what's going on out there. What are you hearing from teachers and administrators? How many here in Maine are experiencing disruptive behavior from students that are making it difficult for them to do their jobs?
Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks for having me. So a colleague and I, we did a survey of Maine educators in the spring of 2024, so just about 2 years ago at this point. And really, this all came about because we were both chatting in the summer of 2023 before the school year started. And we sort of have different circles of educator friends, but we're both educators by trade. And we were hearing a very similar story of teachers not wanting to go back to school. And when they were citing why, it was all about behavior. And as somebody who was a teacher for a long time and taught in a behavior school, I was like, it's strange. Like, I was even always excited to go back to school, even knowing that my students struggled with behavior. So we were talking and kind of like, is this a real problem or is this a one-off situation that, we're just hearing from a couple people? And we ended up writing a survey that we distributed across the state. And we actually launched it on Valentine's Day in 2024. And our goal was, we were really hoping 200 people would respond to us and let us know what they were experiencing. Within the first 2 hours, we had over 500 responses and ultimately over 3,400 educators from across the state. responded to the survey. So that's a lot of educators. Maine's a small state, right? So it was a representative of the whole state, you know, from every corner of the state. This is actually when I learned that there's a 100-mile wilderness in Maine, because I was like, nobody responded from that section. But then my friend told me that nobody lives there. But
There's a
anyway,
reason it's called the wilderness, right?
yeah, I just didn't know it was a thing. I've only been in Maine for 4 years, so still learning things. But anyway, I mean, 3,400 plus responses is a lot. So clearly we hit, you know, a topic that people wanted to share about and talk about. And on top of that, my email address was connected to the survey, so folks started emailing me their stories. And even as somebody who studies behavior in school and loves kids and does this as a living, I was really surprised about what we were hearing. Basically, almost every educator who responded to the survey had experienced disruptive behavior daily, weekly, multiple times a day in their schools. And these were educators that were teachers, they were ed techs, they were administrators. Kind of we used the term educator broadly because we wanted to know what those experiences were. And we asked really about three different kinds of behavior. So disruptive behavior, and we define that as sort of those momentary interruptions to class, and then behavior crises on the other end of the spectrum where safety was a concern, and then kind of that middle ground of what we call the behavioral incident. And overall, there were high numbers of educators saying that they were experiencing all of these things. I mean, 48% of the educators who responded, so just about half, you know, said that they were experiencing and dealing with, like hands-on dealing with, behavioral crises on a weekly basis. And those are a lot of educators who aren't necessarily trained, right? We would might expect that from somebody in a behavior setting, but we don't necessarily expect that from a general education teacher who's just trying to do their job in teaching a classroom full of students every day and who may or may not have been trained in any way to deal with extensive behaviors. And then, you know, it was, you know, 98% had disruptive behaviors daily. And I think the volume of that, while we might expect some disruptive behaviors in schools because kids are kids, that volume is a lot, and it's taking a lot of time away from the teachers being able to do what they need to do to teach.
Dr. Green, why? Why is this on the rise?
Oh my goodness. Lots and lots of reasons, I think. A lot of people point toward COVID. I don't. These trends were in motion well before COVID. We know that we're seeing heightened, very high rates of anxiety and depression and concerning behavior and suicidality and chronic school absenteeism in our kids. Chronic school absenteeism higher in Maine than the national average. I think Maine is around 28%. Families are struggling. But if I were to look inside of schools for part of the answer to that question, I would look at changes that have occurred over the last 2, 3 decades in our schools. And the two that trouble me the most are high stakes testing, where we told educators that every kid had to get over the same bar by the end of the school year, and that their job performance and job security was going to be judged by that, and zero tolerance policies, which many people don't know this, but were a response to Columbine and were an effort to keep our schools safer, but basically involved ramping up consequences, mostly punishment. And the data are in on zero tolerance. They made things worse. Lots of educators have said to me, high stakes testing took all the humanity out of my job. And I'm one of those people who thinks it's time to put the humanity back in the job because things have not been going so well if what we're primarily telling educators is that they're basically test prep robots. No one wants that job.
Ryan Gleason, you have been in several school districts in Maine. You've seen kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and you've been in Maine schools for almost 20 years. I'm wondering if you have seen in your own experience an increase in disruptive behavior and what you attribute it to.
Yes, definitely. This is my 34th year in education.
Oh,
in a
I
variety
did my math
of
wrong.
Roles. Yes. In that time, and I think our book really gets into this and really reflects on some of the complexity that has become part of the lives of children today. Social media, constant stimulation, academic pressure, as Ross shared, thoughts around less unstructured play, interaction. There's a host of things that the book discusses, some more intense than others. And as a result, we're just seeing kids come in less relational and sometimes more aggressive. And so schools were largely built around the assumption that if students are motivated enough, they'll meet expectations. And when kids struggle, the traditional response has been rewards, punishment, consequences. And really, as we'll get into, our thinking is around, it's about skills. It's about skills that students are lacking. And often the focus is on the behavior, and in many schools. And when the focus is on changing the behavior and rewards and punishments come into play. Interestingly enough, I just got back from a national conference on at-risk students. And there's a growing body of brain research that talks about the cortisol impact of rewards and punishments and brain development. And so what has worked historically for many kids, not all kids, is not working for many kids. And so So I think that plays into why so many students are continuing to struggle as they're coming with more complex problems, more complex challenges, and we're still responding the way we've traditionally responded, even though it's not working for those kids.
I want to build on a couple of things you said, Ryan Gleason. The first is talking about kids not having relational skills. And what do you mean by that?
Well, the ability to be on the, I'm at elementary level, so I'll give you an elementary example. I'm at Foursquare, and the ball's in or the ball's out. And the unsolved problem right there, right, is there's some disagreement about whether or not the ball is in and out in Foursquare. And the ability to talk that out as an eight-year-old, come to a compromise, and move on with the game has become more challenging for many students because they don't have that relational skill. And because that skill, the expectation in the moment is to navigate that conversation. And if students don't have that skill set, that's when we start to see some of the maladaptive behavior come into play. And you sometimes will see a more aggressive response to try to meet that need.
And Ryan, I want to ask you about how things always have been. Many people listening to this program are my age or older and probably grew up in a world in which if you were misbehaving in class, you might have had to sit at a desk outside of the classroom in the hallway and cool down a little bit. Or maybe the teacher would say something like, if you guys are all quiet for the next hour, we're going to have an extra recess today. You're saying things like that no longer work.
Well, they work for some kids. But they don't work for all kids. And I think sometimes for many kids who maybe have the skills, sometimes we think that it's the consequence that is shifting the behavior. But that's not always the case. And for many of our kids, it doesn't shift the behavior, because we haven't gotten to the root of what's causing the behavior. So I think that as we study child development and the brain and what's typical developmentally and what's not, what we're finding is that those consequences alone don't work because they aren't working.
Sarah, this is interesting to me because we're having this conversation about how children haven't developed skills they need to relate to one another. By the time they're hitting elementary school. At the same time, there is more pre-K, there's more kindergarten than there ever was in Maine, and more kids are being brought together in educational settings earlier. what does society need to be doing if not that?
I don't think it's really a case of that kids aren't going to school, right? But I think it's what they're being taught. And I agree that sort of what we're hung up on and what's visible to people are the behaviors. But we all have to remember that behavior is a form of communication, right? And every behavior is communicating to us some need that that student has. And often that need is a skill that they don't already have or is not strong enough. So whether it's a communication skill or a cooperation skill or an organizational skill, like there's all sorts of things that basically the students don't have a better way to communicate their need than whatever is presenting in the behavior. So stopping at the behavior is not enough. We really have to dig down to what the root cause is and why are they behaving the way they are? Is it a communication skill issue? And I think to go back to what you were saying earlier about kids in school, I mean, I think we need to be teaching those skills before we, and don't get me wrong, reading and math are important. Like, I'm not saying we don't teach kids literacy, but we also need to be spending time, especially when they're first entering school, on those other sort of functional skills, things that help us live our lives. Because once those students have those skills, then they can engage in problem solving and advocating for themselves and asking for help in ways that don't present as maladaptive behaviors or problem behaviors.
Dr. Green, you've done this work for a very long time and have developed a philosophy. Can you tell us in a nutshell what that philosophy is?
Well, first, the philosophy starts with a mentality called kids do well if they can, which is the belief that if a kid could do well, they would do well. That's a big deal because the prevailing mentality for a very long time has been kids do well if they wanna, which is the belief that if a kid isn't doing well, it's because they don't wanna do well, and therefore it's the adult's job to make the kid wanna do well. Well, as Mr. Gleason pointed out, the kids who are struggling the most, we've been trying to make them want to do well for a long time, and it's not working. And by the way, in the schools that I'm consulting with in Maine, it's the same 10, 12, 15 kids who are accounting for 70 to 80% of the discipline referrals and a very high percentage of the punitive discipline that is doled out following those referrals. It's not working. So, and those kids are taking up mammoth amounts of time. Those kids are some of the reason teachers are getting hit and kicked and spit on. Ed techs, paraprofessionals, that's no fun. But here's the interesting piece. Kids do well if they can aside. If we're focused on a kid's concerning behavior, which I view as their frustration response, we're going to be late every time because the behavior comes after an expectation that a student is having difficulty meeting, what we refer to as an unsolved problem. Here's the good part about the unsolved problems. They're not new. This is not the first time Timmy has had difficulty agreeing on the rules of the four-square game at recess. It's the 197th time. And that makes it an old unsolved problem, which means it can be identified proactively, it can be solved proactively, way before Timmy exhibits a concerning behavior, and way before a whole bunch of the other things that we're teaching educators to do, restraint, seclusion, de-escalating, way before those things kick in and cause harm. So a huge part of this involves a shift in our mentality, a shift in our practices, and a huge part of the shift in practices means moving from late to early, crisis management to crisis prevention. When we are consumed with being early, when we are in crisis prevention mode almost full time, we almost never have to use those crisis management procedures. Schools are spending tens of thousands of dollars on every year. We need to be teaching educators what to do so they can be early and out in front of it instead of late.
I want to talk more about this, but we do need to go to a break. What are your questions or comments? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about behavioral issues in schools. Our guest today, Sarah Wilkinson, a consultant for Maine DOE, an assistant professor of special education at USM, Ryan Gleason, principal of Yarmouth Elementary School, and Ross Green, a psychologist who founded Lives in the Balance. His new book is called The Kids Who Aren't Okay. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. I want to follow up on just a little bit of what Dr. Green was saying before we move on with the program. And I'll turn to you, Sarah. I'm imagining there are people listening and hearing what he says, that we need to focus on crisis prevention, that we need to think about rethinking the way we approach potentially disruptive kids earlier. And I can hear someone saying, well, that's wonderful, but it's awfully idealistic with everything else we ask of teachers all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. But I did want to say that I do agree with Dr. Green in that a lot of what we're focusing on are the response pieces to behavior, right? The restraint, the seclusion, suspension. Even if you look at legislation that has been proposed over the last year or two, those are the things that it's focusing on. And one of my big concerns, and a big concern that I had throughout even our research with the survey, was if we focus so much on those things, and that's what we're training, and that's what we're providing schools money to, you know, have professional development on, and that's what we're writing laws about, then that's going to be the knee-jerk reaction when anything happens, because we're not spending the time and the effort and the resources on those prevention strategies. A lot of my work focuses on prevention, is based in prevention science. And I think while we could say it's idealistic, I mean, it's also science and there's evidence behind it. I think we are just not putting our resources, and when I say we, I mean broadly, big picture, we in education, behind those pieces. I understand that it's really challenging because if we feel like we're putting out fires, it's hard to take that step back. But it really, I would argue, it's the key to really starting to find a solution for those challenges. You know, I recently, I've done a lot of work in multi-tiered systems of support, which are focused on prevention. And the idea there is that, you know, we're intervening, we're providing students supports early in no matter what domain, behavior, social, emotional, academic, before they get to a point where it turns into a crisis, before it gets to a point where they're reading so far behind grade level. These are things that we know how to do, and we're just not doing them. I think one thing that could be helpful, and I, you know, it's so we don't know what the exact solution is or what's going to happen through policy, but the new education funding bill that's in front of the legislature right now, or in front of the education committee, proposes regional centers to provide professional development for educators. And I think that that's a smart idea if that professional development focuses on these prevention frameworks rather than the de-escalation, the restraint, the seclusion, the suspension, all of these things that we kind of traditionally do instead.
Ryan Gleason, I want to ask you as a principal and a former teacher, what does this look like on the ground? What do these preventative practices look like on the ground at your elementary school?
Yeah, so it really starts with, and I'll piggyback on some of what Sarah had just shared too. I do think a little bit about that idealism piece. I think this is an idealistic profession, and I think we want idealistic people to be in this profession. And I think as school leaders, it's our goal to give them the supports and the resources to fuel that idealism and continue that. So in terms of what it looks on the ground, I think it starts with first having a common understanding of what behavior is and what it isn't, and how we support it. I think if you have a staff that has very different understanding and response as to what is going to make things better for the kid and also make things better for them as a teacher, then it's going to be really challenging. So I think everyone has to have the same lenses, you know, to start. So in the schools that I've worked with, as we've brought this into the school, one of the first steps that we've had to do was really kind of shift those lenses and an understanding. And once we have that shared understanding, then we can start talking about, okay, here's the symptom of what the challenge is. What are we going to do about it in our school? One of the things, and I'll just share this kind of quickly, but we do have a foundation document in our school that we created together, and it's titled In Our School. And if you bear with me, I'm actually going to share just a few lines from it. But in our school, we connect before we correct. We get curious, not furious. We understand that behavior is communication. We believe in co-regulation, that kids regulate off the adults in their lives. We empathize when someone is flipping their lid. We believe kids do well when they can. We believe in restoration, not punishment. We know that relationships buffer stress and build resilience. We see you, we hear you, we are with you. All of us need each other always. And we review this periodically. We post it. We, again, it's getting grounded in that mindset around this is as a school how we think about these challenges that students have. And then in terms of what it looks like, you know, in the schools that I've been in, one of the things that we really have started with is thinking about how do we build capacity amongst the staff. You know, and we've done been involved in a variety of things in a variety of places based on where that school was at, how it was structured. But it's how do you build people who really are mobilized and leading throughout the school around this work. And supporting the professional development piece, that was something Sarah talked about. You know, in our school, we've made sure that teachers have some training and some skill around this approach as a big tool in their tool belt in the classroom. And then when we talk about kids who continue to struggle and teachers are feeling like I'm trying these things in my tool belt and they're not working, we make sure that this is part of the solution and the lens that we're looking at it through. And so what my experience has been is when we've been focused on more transactional approaches rather than relationship-based approaches, we tend to not have as durable solution for students. And when we make that shift to being more relational, and I don't think that's a new concept for educators. I think obviously for years and years and years, educators have understood you need to build positive relationships with students. But how you do that and how you maintain that when things get hard has shifted a bit. And so what we talk about in the book is how this approach can help with those things. And actually, I think it deepens relationships and it deepens trust when you're able to lean into this approach. And, you know, so that's a very broad brush of kind of what it looks like. But getting into the weeds, it's, you know, you need to support teachers rather than expect them to do it alone, certainly. And how do you have systems and structures and training that can do that? So, for example, you know, when teachers are having a challenge with a student and it's time for what we call a problem-solving conversation, we have a team, myself, the assistant principal, the counselors, the social worker here, that say, we'll cover your class for 20 minutes if you need to pop out so that you can have a structured problem-solving conversation to work through this and do that proactively. We often say, if you're feeling not as confident, you know, with having that conversation, we'll sit with you, you know, and we'll have that conversation. I can tell you in the last 3 weeks, I've sat in on 5 of these conversations with teachers and with kids, ranging from The meeting I was just at for the kid, this kiddo who's having a hard time at home, bringing home math homework, and what that's looking like. It's an unsolved problem to the student who in morning meeting is struggling with being the dart frog in the morning meeting game. You know, these are big problems for kids. And so we have to see it through their lenses and work with them. So it's really, how do you build up that? How do you build up density? How do you build up structures and systems where you've got it part of your technical, how we do things, but also part of your adaptive culture, how we do things.
On the line with us now is Paige Nichols, who's Chief Innovation Officer with the Maine Department of Education's Office of Innovation. Thanks so much for calling in, Paige.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
As I'm sure you've heard, we've been talking a lot about building capacity and helping teachers. What is the state doing to try to help teachers help the students who may be disruptive?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for that question, Jennifer. We're continuously working on finding solutions that support teachers, counselors, administrators, as they develop and maintain the conditions and practices that reduce student behavior. So our aim is always to understand the needs in the field and then develop resources and opportunities to address those needs so that local districts can make decisions about what solutions they believe will best fit their communities. So some of the recent investments we've made are BAR, which some may be familiar with. This is the one I'm actually most familiar with because I oversee it for the department. BAR stands for Building Assets Reducing Risks, and it's a multi-tiered system of support that provides schools with a framework and coaching that combines relationship building and asset development with real-time data to support students based on their strengths and connections to school. So listening to the conversation that's been happening over the past half hour, I really think this model is one that supports that prevention angle and really focuses on relationship building. And it provides a structure in the school for staff to come together and share what they know personally about students that can help support them from a prevention side of things. The structure itself is, again, multi-tiered. So depending on the severity of interventions necessary, they kind of add supports as needed. But the idea is that every single student in the school is addressed as part of a team meeting of teachers, counselors, administrators, and sometimes community partnerships.
Paige, I understand the law recently was changed in terms of what the state rules are in terms of discipline and physical restraint of students. What is the law and how did it change recently?
Yeah, so I'm my colleague Bear Shea really oversees that, and that's a little out of my wheelhouse. So I'd kind of kick that question to my colleague Bear. I don't want to give any incorrect information as it pertains to that one.
Okay. All right. We can talk with our other guests about that. I guess the big question, Paige, is are there enough resources out there in Maine? Are there enough resources to get teachers the training that they need to be able to deal effectively with this increasing problem?
Yeah, I mean, from a Maine DOE standpoint, I think we are continuing to hear from the field and investing in things that we believe are fitting the needs that we're hearing. The regulated classroom is another one that aims to reduce staff dysregulation and support student engagement, works on co-regulation. I think we've had almost 2,000 participants receive a train-the-trainer training in that. We're continuing to look for opportunities to expand BAR across the state because we've had undeniably positive data reports come in about the impact that that's having. You know, we have PBIS in Maine and a team at the department that's prepared to coach and train and support educators with positive behavior interventions and supports in K-12 settings. So we
you think there are the resources and it's out there. It just is a matter of deploying it.
Yes, I think so.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Paige, thanks so much for calling in. Paige Nichols is Chief Innovation Officer with the Maine Department of Education. I guess I'll throw this question then to you, Sarah. Are you familiar with the new law about restraint and discipline in Maine schools?
So last spring, there was kind of a rewording of the restraint and seclusion law. One of the things that sort of they changed in that law or in the language of the law was they took out the word voluntary from part of the law, and escort of a student is supposed to be voluntary, which means that they're supposed to be walking with you. You're not supposed to drag the student, basically. That would.
Oh, shoot. Sarah froze. Dr. Green, go ahead.
There, she's back.
Oh, okay. Sorry. You know what I'm going to do? Go ahead.
Very good.
So Dr. Green, why don't you weigh in here? Because I know this is something you opposed was passed anyway.
Well, Maine courageously passed a bill, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago, making it harder to restrain and seclude its students. Not too long ago, they eased up on those regulations a little bit. I still think that Maine is ahead of many states as it relates to restrictions on restraining and secluding kids. So I think that's good. I wish we could make the same progress in all of the other states in which we are legislatively involved. But here's the bottom line on restraint and seclusion. They're as late as it gets. They are often acts of desperation that occur after we've tried to de-escalate, which occurred after a student's frustration response, which occurred, here we go again, after an expectation a student is having difficulty meeting. If an intervention is primarily focused on behavior or on regulating a student or an adult after it's already getting ugly, count me out. All the relationship enhancement that we've done, which is admirable, still doesn't solve any of the problems that are causing students to exhibit concerning behavior in the first place. Until we start solving those problems, we can consequence as much as we want. We can put kids in timeout rooms as much as we want. We can de-escalate as much as we want. As long as those problems are not identified and solved proactively, we will always find ourselves in the heat of the moment, yet again, dealing with a kid's concerning behavior.
All right. Well, we are going to hear from a mom who's dealt with this in the schools. But first, we need to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about behavior issues in schools and new philosophies about the best way to help teachers and staff. With us, Ross Green, a psychologist and author who founded Lives in the Balance. Sarah Wilkinson, who teaches special education at USM and is a former special ed teacher. And Ryan Gleason, principal of Yarmouth Elementary School. We're going to go now to Angela Dupuy. Angela is a mom, and she has a background as a nurse. And working with hospice, she and her son have struggled for years to find the right school situation for him. Thank you so much for calling in, Angela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I understand your son's now 14. How old was he when you started to be contacted by the schools, when you started to figure out that something needed to change?
Grade when things kind of started bubbling up. Kindergarten had been a great year, but first grade quickly became different than kindergarten.
And how was he treated? What did he do, and what happened to him?
So at first, it kind of started with mildly disruptive behaviors. We had, you know, kind of realized pretty on in our parenting journey that, you know, our kiddo responded to a different approach than kind of the way we had been taught how to manage kids and behaviors, and, you know, started seeking resources on, you know, how to manage behavior and how to keep the peace in the home. And, you know, he was kind of getting in power struggles with his teacher. She was pretty green herself. And so I'm sure, as, you know, someone who's been a new professional at one point, it's a learning curve. And, you know, so we really tried to work with her, but things started to escalate, and he became more disruptive. And a sort of cycle started where he was getting dismissed from the classroom a lot, and then it kind of escalated into, you know, going into a different classroom, going into a seclusion room, and then restraints started as well. And we saw changes in him at home, you know, just on him not wanting to go to school. I heard you guys talking about that sort of avoidance and increased absences. We certainly saw that with him. And, you know, there was a long wait for evaluation. So while that wait time was happening, things were just getting worse and worse. And what we were saying worked better at home either wasn't realistic or wasn't, you know, they weren't buying into that approach at that time. So we were sort of floundering for a while.
Yeah, Angela, you say floundering for a while. I mean, this is 8 years of trying to find the right solution for your son. How many schools did he end up going to, and how is he doing today?
Yeah, well, we kind of, in that floundering, there has been some success, you know, so we've been able to see, like, okay, what works and what doesn't. And there were some years in the public school system where we live that were really great, and they were more collaborative, and they sort of listened to what was working at home, found ways to kind of implement those more proactive solutions rather than, you know, like the reactive. There was often the years that weren't great, there was like a lot of shame and kind of stigma. The reward and punishment systems, those things, you know, don't really work for our kiddo. So when, you know, we had some years that were more collaborative, it was great. But during COVID, things really fell apart that first year back to school. There was no collaboration when we tried to leverage our kiddo's voice into like what his experience was. You know, it was not welcomed. And there was just sort of shrugging. So we kind of went back to the home, you know, remote learning model. But that was not sustainable for us as a family or our kiddo either. And so then we ended up in a special purpose private school, but that ended up being a lot more of the same. And even when he's been doing great at home and in outside community settings with similar expectations to a classroom, there's no trouble. But then when he goes into these restrictive settings where there are a lot of locked doors and a lot of seclusions and restraints happening and a lot of aggressive behaviors, everything comes back. So the determination is that he needs more restriction and, you know, more support rather than a different approach. So we had to find, and actually last year we found a school in Orlando, the school around us, it's a very unrestrictive environment, and they use naturally within their framework a lot of the things that this crew is talking about here today that are really like the magic keys for our kiddo. And he's been able to now feel safe again in school for 2 years in a row, which has been really life-changing for him.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story and giving us, a difficult example of the kind of journey that families can be on. Angela Dupuy is a mother who lives in Saco. We have so many questions coming in so little time. I'm going to sort of combine some of them. Dr. Green, many people are asking about screen time and how that impacts what we're talking about, behavioral issues. What do you think about that? That children have smartphones from a very young age?
Well, I think we're stuck with it. And I think that the most definitive thing that can be said about it without underplaying its impact is that the kids who are overusing screens the most are the ones whose mental health is most adversely affected by it. I think that's the most definitive thing that can be said from a research perspective. Are there things in online that we don't want kids to see that they're seeing at a very early age? Are there dark corners of the web we don't want kids finding their way into? No doubt about it. Is that something schools can do a lot about? Not too sure about that. I'd rather see schools focus on being proactive. I'd rather than see them meet every kid where they're at and have every kid be their own reference point, rather than focus on high stakes testing. And I'd rather they be much more oriented towards solving problems with kids than on modifying their frustration responses. So social media is a real thing. If we get too caught up in it, we miss everything else that's going on with our kids these days that we can do something about.
We'll go to Danielle calling from Portland. Hi, Danielle, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to advocate for community mentorship programs for children, such as Big Brothers, Big Sisters. I've been a big now for a year and a half, and I've seen my little just come so far. And it takes a village. And so I'm just a citizen with a few extra hours every week that I can devote to this child. And it's worked wonders. And I think that there's opportunities like that out there for parents to sign their kids up if they might need a little extra supervision during the school day to do something different. It's just a positive thing all around, I think.
Danielle, thank you so much for calling. Sarah, I saw you nodding while Danielle was speaking.
I think that community partnerships are great, and there are lots of ways out there. And I think what Danielle was sort of getting at is what we were talking about earlier, where having a big brother, big sister, that those kinds of programs are helping students to develop those sort of interpersonal skills and things that maybe that we're not seeing them have the way we might expect when they get to school. So I think these are opportunities where kids can find mentors or, you know, have mentors that can do fun things with them, but teach them some sort of life skills and communication skills and things along the way. I think probably everyone said it at some point now, but, you know, relationships are a protective factor for kids. Strong relationships are a protective factor, that when kids have strong relationships, they tend not to have as many challenges. So I think that, you know, any ways that we can provide positive role models for students is great. If we could bring those things into schools and partner with between schools and community, even better.
Danielle, thanks so much for your call. An email here from Mike. What percentage of kids who are not okay come from abusive or dysfunctional home environments? Ryan, I'll send this to you.
Well, it's interesting. When you were introducing me and you mentioned I'd worked in schools that had different socioeconomic backgrounds, I would say that students who have challenges have different types of challenges from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. We have students that come from homes that are upper middle class that present with mental health challenges. We have students that come from low socioeconomic environments whose students are very successful and some who aren't as successful. So I don't know that I could give you sort of a generalization, you know, to say that, you know, yes, this is the case. I would say there are more unsolved problems often when there are challenges around some basic needs. You know, I think that's fair, you know, to say, and that can manifest itself into challenges in school, you know, when some of those needs aren't being met.
Dr. Green.
I think that what I'm always reminded of is that we tend to look, and not that Mike was doing this with his email, is that we tend to look outside the school building when a kid is struggling at school. The fact is, there are a lot of kids in our schools who are going home to environments that are not exactly ideal, who are doing very well in school. I wish that we would primarily be focused on the things we can do in school if we are educators, rather than looking outside the building, because the things that are going outside the building are things we may not be able to do very much about. There's no doubt that it's there. Let's focus on what we can do in the building to make this the absolute best experience possible for the kid. That's going to serve everybody well, especially the ones who are going home to something that isn't exactly ideal.
All right. We have an email here from Karen. It is hopeful to hear this conversation being shared with the masses. As a retired secondary public school teacher of 38 years, I have one main message. The hurt a disruptive child creates is never greater than the hurt they feel. Dr. Green, do you agree with that?
Totally.
Yeah.
And the hurt goes beyond the kid. It goes into the family. Boy, do I work with a lot of families that are suffering mightily because of difficulties their child is having at school. We heard from one during this program. If there's an epidemic of that, boy, a lot of pain out there. Good solutions. We need to implement them.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Lizzie, I'm going to give you about 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Lizzie. I just wanted to let people know that if they find themselves in this position, there are some legal resources. Pine Tree Legal Assistance has a wing called Kids Legal. It is free to find out whether you can get some help or not. Disability Rights Maine also helps when you find yourself in this position, particularly with a child with an IEP. Children with IEPs find themselves in restraint and seclusion at much higher rates than other kids. There is legal help out there for you. And if you feel like you need to talk to somebody about what's going on with your kid at school, that's a great place
to start. Thank you, Lizzie, for calling in. And that will be our last call of the hour. I apologize to everybody who didn't get through. And thank you to our guest, Dr. Ross Green, a psychologist and founding director of Lives in the Balance. He's also the author of several books on child behavior, the latest, The Kids Who Aren't Okay. Dr. Sarah Wilkinson, assistant professor of special education at USM, as well as a consultant for the Maine Department of Education, and Ryan Gleason, principal of Yarmouth Elementary School. He works with Dr. Green and co-authored The Kids Who Aren't Okay. Today's sound engineer was Jessica Miller. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.